Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Delighted to have back on Church and Culture Charles A. Colomb, who between this interview and the last one has become the film critic for the Church Christian Review, the website that I publish and edit. And last time he was here, you may recall we were talking about his book from Tan Books, A Catholic Quest for the Holy Grail. And we had a great discussion. It's a great book. Fascinating. Among many books that Charles has published, he's from New York City, although he moved out to Hollywood, California, at the age of six. His first book, Every Man Today Call Rome, was a look at the Catholic Church. He published it in 1987. And since then, he's published a variety of other books written for more than 20 journals and is well known really internationally as a lecturer and a raconteur. During the sad afterpath of the death of John Paul II, now St. John Paul II, he was often on ABC providing commentary. Charles, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Thank you. Great to be back, Dale.
Now, the reason I have invited you on is because I just finished reading a book on Vatican I, and particularly about Pius IX. And, of course, Pius IX was the Pope who saw the papal states taken away from him by Italian revolutionaries to the point where he actually lost Rome just after the council was ended of Vatican I in 1870. France had to withdraw its protection of him, and the papal army put up a sort of a fight at the Roman wall, but eventually they were broken. And for the first time, Italy was unified and has been unified ever since. But you are a person well known for your writings and your lectures on monarchism, on the concept, I think, of the Christian ruler. Am I correct?
Yeah, you're very true. It's one of the topics I deal with, but yes, indeed.
Now tell, why are you drawn to the concept of monarchy?
Well, I suppose it's my first impulse is religious. Now, mind you, American Catholics, of course, are always brought up with the idea that to show that we're good Americans, we have to forget all that. And we have. But the truth of the matter is that it's Christ the King. Not Christ the president, not Christ the representative. And for most of European and Catholic history, the interconnection between monarchy and the faith has been as obvious as that between party politics and elections here. It simply was what it was. The coronation rites of the different European countries, the papacy itself, which is certainly a monarchy, that was the beginning of it. Part of it was my family background, because I was very much aware of being of French-Canadian descent, of the role the House of Bourbon played in sending my ancestors here. Living in California, I was very much aware of Father Serra being financed by the Spanish crown, the whole thing being a dual church and state venture. And similarly, in New York, I was very much aware of the Dutch and British monarchical background of the place. So part of it was historical, and also my dad had a good deal of Scots blood, so he had an affection for the Stuarts or the Jacobites. And my mother's family had quite an affection for the Habsburgs. So I didn't have quite the same anti-monarchical prejudices that a lot of people have in this country.
Now, is it a prejudice, you would say, to not desire to have a king or queen rather than an elected president?
Well, I would, because very often, quite apart from our own experience in this country, which after all was founded in a revolt from a monarchy, and spent a good piece of its history picking up pieces of land from other monarchies. Latterly, the...
That was good, Charles. Okay, go ahead.
It's true. You know, I mean, generally speaking, you don't really like the people you take stuff from. It's just the way it works.
Right.
But, you know, ending, as I say, with the Kingdom of Hawaii and the Kingdom of Denmark, but the Virgin Islands, just so you know. But the thing was that the lack of understanding of monarchy has bedeviled us ever since we became a world power.
How have we misunderstood it?
Well, we think that anything is better. Anything at all. Doesn't matter what it is. As long as it calls itself a republic, it's good. If it calls itself a monarchy, it's bad.
Give us an example.
Glad to do so. Woodrow Wilson was absolutely insistent that Austria-Hungary had to be chopped up and the Habsburgs had to go. And the Kaiser had to get out of Germany. End of story, full stop, nothing can be said.
Well, but the United States did support the Tsar's White Russian army.
The White Russians were not all monarchists. Remember, the Tsar had abdicated, and the whites were a mixture of monarchists, Republicans, basically anybody who didn't like the Reds. And they were the government that they were seeking to restore was itself a republic. They were not fighting to restore the monarchy. Some of them were. But the ostensible immediate goal was to restore the regime that was overthrown with Kerensky. And Kerensky, Wilson was very fond of.
That wasn't a full-hearted support for the Tsar.
Not at all.
For the Romanovs.
Not at all. And the sad truth of the matter is that some of our American troops over there in Russia, the intervention, actually smuggled weaponry to the Reds, so who were probably more of a problem than a help. But that wasn't the intention, of course. To bring it further on, closer to our own time, during the World War II, despite Churchill's warnings, we very happily backed Tito's communists over the royalist guerrillas in Yugoslavia. That turned out very well. We were keen after the war to see the Middle Eastern monarchies in Egypt and Iraq and places like that overthrown, Libya. And finally Iran, you know, greasing the skids, as Nixon put it, for the Shah. All of which have simply given us more trouble. I think probably the thing that really caught my attention in this area was Madeleine Albright during the Mr. Clinton's war with Serbia, when it was pointed out that the only real opposition to Milosevic in Serbia were the monarchists, the royalists, who wanted their king restored. And Madeleine Albright's response was perfect. She said, "We don't do kings."
Yes.
And I thought to myself, so in other words, it's better to bomb them than to assist them in overthrowing Milosevic and restoring me. All right. It all makes sense now. This kind of policy, I could go on and on, Dao Dai in Vietnam, Haida Selassie in Ethiopia. We're always happy when these people get overthrown, and we always pay the price, one way or the other, most often in money and sometimes in blood.
Well, among some Catholics, I guess, that I would call trads, traditionalists,
mm-hmm. Sure.
I often run into this kind of nostalgic desire or reverence for the Christian ruler, the saintly Christian ruler. Did that ever actually exist, Charles?
Oh, absolutely. Most recently in the person of the Emperor Karl in Austria-Hungary, the last Emperor of Austria and our opponent in World War I.
He wasn't a very nice man, was he?
Well, three miracles would indicate otherwise, but no, it was the same.
Now, tell me about that. I just don't know. Go ahead. Tell me.
Well, the Emperor Karl was not expected when he was born to be the Emperor of Austria. He wasn't the heir to the throne, but the son of the reigning emperor died. Franz Ferdinand, his uncle, succeeded as heir, but he married Morgan Hattie, as they say. So his children were not going to inherit, and that's how it ended up with Karl being the heir. And when his uncle was murdered at Sarajevo, he was on the spot, as it were. But he was a very devout Catholic. He was a very good family man, devoted father. When he became emperor, having actually served at the front himself, when he became emperor in 1916, he was very, although he'd been very brave in battle, he immediately began to cast around for peace. He was the only European ruler, or American for that matter, who took Benedict XV's appeal for peace and the peace plan seriously.
Okay, now I'm learning something. Keep going. This is interesting. Go ahead.
He opened up negotiations privately with the French to his brothers-in-law, because his wife, Zita Bourbon-Parma, her brothers were serving the French army. So he hoped to negotiate a separate peace and bring Austria out of the war, perhaps as early as early 1917. But Clemenceau, who was no friend of the Habsburgs or the Church, spilled the beans to the Kaiser.
Now, we are talking about Charles the First of Austria?
The First of Austria, correct, who was beatified in 2004 and who has just gotten his the necessary miracle approved for sainthood.
What, do you know anything about the miracles?
Well, I know about I do, actually. There were two of them so far.
He was only 34 when he died.
That's correct. He died, I'll get to that, but yes, he was only 34. He was quite a young man. The first miracle was of a Brazilian nun who was suffering from cancer. And oddly enough, had the same name as his wife, Zita. And she was completely cured after praying to for the emperor's intercession. The second miracle was from a non-Catholic, a Baptist at least. And again, a complete cure. His body is incorrupt.
Where is it?
In Madeira. You see, what happened
In Portugal.
In the island, the Portuguese island in the middle of
yeah.
the Atlantic. What happened was that when the Allies defeated the Central Powers, Austria-Hungary basically collapsed. Woodrow Wilson made it very clear that if the monarchies were not ended in both Germany and Austria, then the embargo would continue. And since they were starving, that was pretty much that. So
he was really only a sovereign for 2 years.
That is correct. And in that time, he managed a lot of ways to revolutionize administration. Court carriages to deliver supplies to the poor, established what we would call a social welfare ministry, the first one ever in Europe. Did a lot of things of that sort. And he also forbade the use of gas as far as the army went, he forbade the use of gas, and he forbade the attacking of unarmed civilian ships by Austrian submarines.
Oh, no, he forbade the use of gas attacks in World War I?
Right, by the Austrian army.
Right.
The Germans, the French, the Americans, the British all used them, but he forbade his troops to use them. And the interesting thing is that one of the objections at the time he was beatified was he commanded an army that used poison gas. Or no, he didn't, actually. He forbade it. But that's your public press. Very often they're misinformed about the most basic things. Anyway.
Now, wait a minute. Don't trudge on yet. So here we have a son of the famous Emperor Franz Joseph.
Not a son, a great-nephew.
So, nephew. Because one son was one shot at Sarajevo. Correct?
Well, no. Franz Joseph had only one son, died under mysterious
circumstances. Oh, that's the one of, that the films have been made about.
Exactly.
With his girlfriend or mistress or...
or whatever she was. You bet.
Yeah, that's, he, Charles Boyer played him. Mayerling, in Mayerling, Austria.
That's the one. And there's actually a Carmelite monastery there today. The emperor gave it to the Carmelite nuns, and they prayed for the repose of the souls.
So when Franz Ferdinand was assassinated in 1914, Charles became the heir.
Right.
And, of course, actually, Franz Joseph then stepped down before he died. Because he didn't die until 1922.
Carl died in 1922. Franz Joseph died in 1916.
Franz Joseph, I'm looking at it. It says he died in 1922.
Believe me, it may say that, but I'm
that's okay. Right. That's incorrect. Then
it's absolutely correct
because that would make sense why Charles I became the emperor in 1916. Correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he
was beatified by Saint John Paul II in 2004, known as Blessed Carl of Austria, and he had a lot of children, did he not?
He sure did, one of whom I had the privilege of knowing. He had eight, as I recall, the last of whom was conceived and born when they were in exile.
In Portugal.
Well, first in Switzerland, conceived, I guess, and then born in Madeira. And one of the reasons why that's important is because it showed the child was born after he died. But it showed his commitment to family life, even though everything was falling apart around him.
So this Charles, by the way, he died rather carelessly of pneumonia leading to some sort of infection and heart failure.
That's correct. What happened was that twice he and his wife attempted to regain control of Hungary. They failed. And so the Allies exiled them to the island of Madeira, where they figured they couldn't get any mischief. They were quartered in a summer villa up in the mountains. Now, the problem with a summer villa up in the mountains is that it's not really a good place to live during the winter. But because the Allies also cut off their income, they couldn't afford anything else. And so he contracted the disease, and he died there.
So... you've given me a very good counter-argument in the figure of Charles I, who is, as you say, on his way to sainthood, it would appear. And you've also described him as a benevolent ruler, someone who thought about his people, thought about their needs. And was he beloved of people?
He certainly was, and what's interesting about that, he was absolutely, during his own time, considered something of a saint while he was still alive. When he died, the mourning was tremendous in the different parts of the now partitioned empire. What's been interesting to me is that since his beatification, his cultus, his devotion to him, has really mushroomed in Austria, as you can expect, but amongst the Czechs, who were not exactly what you would call great pals of Habsburgs for a lot of their history. He's become a very popular figure in what we now have to call Czechia. They don't use the word Czech Republic anymore. Beyond that, has been the growth of devotion to him in Western Europe and in this country, where there are about five shrines in his honor scattered around.
There are some wonderful pictures of he and his wife and family. His wedding wife was Zita.
Yeah.
He was a very handsome, dark-haired man, slight in build, but he looks vigorous and looks darn good in a uniform. And his children look like they're out of the Sound of Music.
Well, indeed. And they were a very close-knit family. They went through a lot of grief, as you can imagine, together. Because when he died, they left Madeira. And they lived for a while in Spain. thanks to King Alfonso XIII. And then from there they moved to Belgium, which is where they were on the eve of World War II. And what was interesting was that by that time, his oldest son, Otto, had been hailed as king and emperor by his supporters in his former countries. But the ruling party in Austria was, at that time, the Christian Socialists, declared that they would one day restore the monarchy sooner or later. Well, when Hitler began to, after killing the chancellor in 1934, Adolphus, Hitler began to actively menace Austria with annexation. And Otto appealed to the then-chancellor, Schuster, to, for a restoration then, so he could lead the fight against Hitler. Well, Schuster didn't do it, but the Nazis were so afraid that he would that they called their plans for the invasion of Austria Case Otto.
Did they really?
Yeah, they did indeed. They were afraid that if he went back, the Austrians, instead of rolling over, which they ended up doing in face of superior manpower, would...
Well, let me ask you this. The next time I go to Austria, and I'm in a restaurant or a bar or someplace where there's a lot of Catholics, and I mention Charles I, or now Blessed, would there be a popular reaction, positive reaction to his name?
There would. You'll find that Austria, not unlike France, not unlike most countries of Europe, or for that matter, the United States today, we've finally caught up in the division business. But you'll find that each of these countries is very much divided over their past. More or less half and half. In Austria, to this day, at least half the people are devoted to the memory of the Habsburgs, and certainly the devout Catholics tend to, particularly the Emperor Karl. The Socialists, on the other hand, of course, dislike him intensely. But the thing I have to point out about that is that their hero was a man called Karl Renner, who was the first Austrian socialist leader after World War I. What was interesting about him was that, unlike the Habsburgs and their supporters, Renner attempted to collaborate with the Nazis, but they wouldn't take him.
Huh.
Now, it's one thing to be a collaborator with the Nazis. It's another thing to be a collaborator reject.
Right. you're in no man's land, completely.
Well, you know, if even the Nazis figure out you're kind of worthless, what does that say about you?
So, what I'm getting from you in general, but specifically in telling the story of Charles I, the last surviving Habsburg monarch, is that the dream is being kept alive of sometime, some place, some country, probably in Europe, of the monarchy being reestablished?
Oh, certainly. I mean, every year, every country in Europe, and for that matter in Latin America, have their monarchies of varying kinds. It depends. I mean, Italy, for instance, is kind of a strange case because you had, before the House of Savoy took over completely in 1870, you had a number of separate, one kingdom and a bunch of duchies, all of whom have adherents today. But so does the House of Savoy. You even have a few defenders of the idea of papal temples, or temple sovereignty. I wrote a book, by the way, on the Pope's army in that war, from 1860 to 1870, which you may or may not have seen. It's called The Pope's Legion, but it's about the men, the papal's wives, who came from all over the world to fight for the Pope.
I need to read that. I noticed it in your long list of publications, but I don't have it in my hand. So,
it was a fun book to write because there are a bunch whose existence has been kind of airbrushed out of the picture since the latter.
Yes, yeah. I mean, if they had papal states, there had to be a papal army.
There sure were. And they were quite the bunch. It was discovering them was as much or more of a joy as writing about them.
You know, before we go to break, I just want to ask one question. Is Liechtenstein the only European country that is still a monarchy?
Oh, no. Norway, Sweden, Denmark,
But they're constitutional monarchies. Are you counting those?
They are.
Okay, when we come back from break, I want to talk about, I would imagine it's not a constitutional monarchy that you're interested in, but maybe it is. We'll talk more to Charles Colomb about monarchy and monarchism after this short break.
Exactly 100 years ago, in a muddy field in rural Portugal, which at the time was a backwater country, far from the centers of worldly power, the Mother of God appeared to three uneducated shepherd children. Her visitations culminated with an astounding miracle on October 13, 1917, witnessed by over 70,000 people. Our Lady of Fatima foretold the spread of errors around the world thanks to Russia, and the future confusion and conflict in the church surrounding the issue of the family. Sound familiar? Think she was spot on regarding what the future would hold? But no matter what happens here below, God continues to be in charge. He knows all things, is surprised by nothing, and causes no evil, only goodness. Our job is, therefore, to become saints. So be a saint. What else is there? This is Patrick Coffin at patrickcoffin.media.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, don't just go to church. Don't just satisfy an obligation. Rather, live the liturgy, which is an immersion into the truth of life, particularly when it comes to marriage.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm back with Charles Colomb, who was last on Church and Culture talking about his wonderful book, recent book from TAN, A Catholic Quest for the Holy Grail. Before the break, we were talking about European monarchies, many of which are constitutional, but at least one of which is not, and that's Liechtenstein. What about Monaco, Charles? Is it like Liechtenstein in that respect?
It's very similar in the sense that the princely family is really what holds the thing together. For a long time, there was a treaty with France that if they ever failed in the male line, France would gobble up Monaco. So as you can imagine, the Monegasques weren't keen on that. But to this day, the prince has a great deal of influence.
And what is his name?
Albert.
Okay, and how old a man is he?
Oh, he would have asked you. I believe he's in his 50s. His mother was the famous Princess Grace, the American.
We're talking about Liechtenstein now, not Monaco.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, it's my confusion.
Let's go back to Liechtenstein. Who's the ruler in Liechtenstein?
Well, the official ruler is Hans Adam II. But his son is acting as regent. His name is Prince Alois. And Alois is young. He was born in 68. He's 49. And interestingly enough, he married a lady, Duchess Sophie, who's Bavarian. But one day she's going to inherit the Jacobite claims, which is a long story. But basically they're the closest.
You mean the Catholic ruler of England?
Britain. Right. And these United States. So one day, Prince Joseph Wenzel, who's the young man who's Alois's son, will be Prince of Liechtenstein, reigning Prince of Liechtenstein, and heir to the throne of America, perhaps.
Now, are they earnest Catholics?
They are. They're extremely earnest. And in fact, the reason why Liechtenstein now has the curious position does when the prince has an overwhelming say in things, is that a few years ago, Prince Hamzadeh vetoed an abortion bill because the government wanted to bring an abortion. So he said, I don't think we're going to do that. And the government huffed and puffed. And so finally, he said, look, this is what we'll do. We'll have a plebiscite on me.
Oh, on himself?
Yep. If the people want you to run the show, I will leave.
That is pretty courageous.
He said, Liechtenstein will become a republic, and you people can do whatever you want to do. Oh, but if I win, then my veto is final. And you will do what you're told. So
what happened?
They had the plebiscite, and 85% voted for the prince.
Pretty powerful stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And so what was the result of that? What happened to the power of the legislature?
Well, I mean, the abortion, I think that Wittgenstein is the only country in Europe that doesn't have abortion. I mean, not that people can't go, it's so small, they can go anywhere they want to get one. But they can't do it at home.
But it established the prince as the ruler of the country.
Yeah. It established him as the primary force of the state. But with the understanding, and it's made very clear, that the people ever want a republic, all they have to do is vote themselves one.
Now, is Liechtenstein officially a Catholic country?
It is, and it's got almost every feast day you can imagine is a holiday. And interestingly enough, too, it used to be part of the Diocese of Chur in Switzerland. And some years ago, they got the Swiss Church, a lot of areas are very liberal, so they were given by John Paul II, a pretty conservative bishop. And the priests were very upset, and they jumped up and down and shrieked. At the end of the day, but the prince said, we love it. So at the end of the day, Liechtenstein was separated from Chur, and the bishop became simply the Bishop of Liechtenstein.
So Prince Hans hyphen Adam the
right.
Second is the present ruler of Liechtenstein. He's the son of Franz Joseph the Second, Prince of Liechtenstein, and he is how old would he be? You're saying he's 73.
Right, and he's pretty much retired.
He put it in the hands of his. I see here a picture of his son, Prince Hans. No, that's who's his son now?
Alois. A-L-O-I-S.
Yes. Well, he's a very happy-looking guy, and he's the one that married Princess Sophie.
Right.
And do they have any children yet?
Well, they do. They have four. And the oldest is, as I say, Prince Joseph Wenzel. He's 22 now. And he, I suppose that one day he's going to inherit the claims to, the Jacobite claims to the British.
Explain to our listeners what you mean by Jacobite claims. They may not be familiar with that.
Sure. Basically, you may recall that Elizabeth had no children, Elizabeth I. And that was the end of the House of Tudor, which came to power under Henry VII after the end of the War of the Roses. Henry VIII took England out of the church. His daughter Mary tried to bring it back. She died. Her sister Elizabeth becomes queen. The Armada lady, the big red hair, she breaks with the church finally and basically establishes what we now know as the Church of England. Well, she doesn't have any children. Her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots, is her closest heir, and by Catholic accounting was actually the rightful queen. So Elizabeth has eventually, Mary falls into her hands, and eventually Elizabeth has her executed. But her son, Mary, Queen of Scots' son, succeeds Elizabeth on the throne of England.
This is Bonnie, Prince Charlie?
No. This is James VI of Scotland, James I of England.
Uh-huh.
who commemorated the King James Bible.
Right.
Who commissioned the King James Bible. So he is a Presbyterian, I mean, a Episcopalian, a Protestant. There are various kinds all at the same time. His son is Charles I, who's pro-Catholic and fights the English Civil War and gets beheaded.
Yes. The first regicide. The first regicide.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He, in, with Louis XVI and Nicholas II following behind. So, Charles I is king. He dies at the hands of Oliver Cromwell in Parliament. Cromwell rules for 10 years. The country falls apart after he dies. They bring back the oldest son of Charles I, Charles II. He converts on his deathbed. These are called Stuarts. He's succeeded by his brother, James II, who is a Catholic already, and who, in a short space of a few years, annoys the extreme Protestants and the Whig oligarchy enough that they bring over his son-in-law, William of Orange, to replace him. And there is a brief set of fighting in England, Scotland, and Ireland, culminating with the Battle of the Boyne and the Siege of Limerick in Ireland. And William of Orange is established as king. But James goes into exile in France, and the supporters of him and his descendants, his Stuart descendants, are called Jacobites, from the Latin word for James, Jacobus. So William and Mary, James's daughter, have no children. So it goes to Mary's sister, Anne. Now, if her children survive, so they go to the nearest Protestant cousin, the Elector of Hanover, called George I. And he comes over in 1714 when Anne dies. And that was the beginning of the first of the Jacobite Wars, culminating with James's grandson, Bonnie Prince Charlie, trying to take back the throne in 1745.
At Culloden.
Culminating in 1746. So that's the sad story of the Stuarts.
By the way, remind me never to ask you to define something again, because we just got the whole history of 16th and 17th century England. But that's good, though. But one day I'll be able to do that, to keep all those royals in chronological order.
Well, the problem you run into is that our education is so lacking historically. I mean, it's not just with royals. You mention anything. For a large audience to understand it, you've got to suddenly pull out all the history.
I've been doing my best in my dotage to catch up. And that's why I love talking to you, Charles, as well as the other historians I have on my show. Let's transition over to Monaco, which is, I'm sure, to our listeners, much more familiar than Liechtenstein, because we all know Grace Kelly, and we all know she married Prince Rainier, and right in the middle of her Hollywood career, left it all behind, went over to Monaco, fairy tale marriage, so to speak. But then she had, she tragically died in a car accident. Tell us now, since the time of Rainier and Grace, what has gone on in Monaco? What has kept alive the succession?
Well, basically, Prince Albert was something of a playboy before his mother died, and kind of a wild man. But after he became reigning prince, when his father died, he settled down. Got married, produced an heir, and has been very quietly going about the business of ruling Monaco. And that basically means keeping the wheels of governance going, keeping its native people happy and its immigrants. There are more non-Monegasque citizens living in Monaco than natives. It's a little bit like one of the Persian Gulf states that way.
So Albert II, Prince of Monaco, would be what we would call a Catholic ruler, correct?
Yeah. The feast days are, again, as with Liechtenstein, the feast days are all holidays. The royal house, in this case the princely house, I should say, are seen at mass and so on. I would say that they're not quite of the same caliber of practice as the Liechtenstein, but they're, you know,
like Liechtenstein, Monaco official religion is the Catholic faith, and they comprise 83% of the population. Albert marry? How many children do they have?
Well, he married an Australian lady whose name, I think, my poor memory. You get to be 57, you'll see.
I got there a while back. Go ahead.
Well, then start going back would be easier.
Yeah.
No, Charlene, oddly enough, is the name of his wife. And so far, they have had two children. He's also had two illegitimate children, which is kind of a hard getting back to the 17th century, I guess. But it also speaks to his wild man days. He's recognized
them. Does he recognize them?
Yes.
In good 17th century fashion, right?
Exactly right. Exactly. Well, he hasn't given them titles.
So the house is called Grimaldi.
Grimaldi, yes.
And he has sisters, Caroline, we remember her, she's been around, and Princess Stephanie. And then he married Charlene Wittstock. Now, did she become a royal when she married him?
Yes, when you marry, you become one. It's funny, in the Middle Ages, it was less stratified, and a lot of royals married commoners. But in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, it became much, much more stratified. And the house laws of many dynasties forbade them in those days to marry non-royals. If you did, you had what was called a morganatic marriage, like Franz Ferdinand was killed in Sarajevo had. And what that meant was that while you might inherit the throne, your children would. Which is why Karl became emperor of Austria, because although Franz Ferdinand had a number of children, because they're the products of a morganatic marriage, they could not inherit the throne. Well, now, since the 20th century, 21st century, that's been pretty much laid aside. And there are very few reigning royals, other than the Prince of Liechtenstein, who are married royals.
Well, they've had two children. They were twins.
Yeah.
And they, as you say, they have these two recognized children born out of wedlock, Jasmine Grace Grimaldi and Anne Alexandre Coste. Alexandra was the daughter of an Air France flight attendant from Togo.
That's correct.
And Jasmine was a American.
Yes.
It doesn't say here how they were, how they met. But does that create secession issues for them?
No. They're because while there are no longer such things as morganatic marriages, it's very, very rare that any illegitimate child has rights of succession. The one major exception to this, oddly enough, is the House of Braganza in Portugal, who are the remote descendants of an illegitimate child of the old ruling House of Orleans. But that very, very rarely happens.
So there's hope for bastards after all?
Not much.
Although, sorry, I apologize for that. But take it that the Prince Albert, though, wouldn't therefore be your paradigm of a Catholic ruler.
No, I mean, he's a lot better now. Inheriting the throne and becoming it's a little bit, you remember, like Shakespeare's Prince Harry, Prince Hal. His father, Henry IV. When he was king, Prince Hal just runs wild with Falstaff. But then, when he becomes king himself, he suddenly realizes he has responsibility now, and he dumps all his old companions and sits there and buckles down to the work.
Well, you know, moving over to Latin America, what is the situation down there in terms of the legacy or the actual succession of the Catholic rulers in Central South America?
Well, Of course, Brazil settled by the kings of Portugal, and the rest of Latin America by the kings of Spain. And they took a very active role in administration in a way that the British kings, for various reasons, did not. So when the king of Spain and the king of Portugal looked at the map and said, build a city here, they built a city there. That's what Los Angeles owes its origins to, and why we have a statue of Carlos III, who founded us, in the middle of our plaza. But the revolutions that overthrew the Spanish regime in Latin America came about primarily because France had occupied Spain and overthrown the king and replaced him with Napoleon's brother. So that kind of put the Spanish authorities in the New World as sort of a problem. And then you, on top of that, you had some local rebellions that broke out. What's fascinating, though, is that for over 200 years after the immediate aftermath of the conquest, down to the period of the revolutions in the 18-teens and 20s, Spain ruled the area from California to Patagonia with a minimum of military might, of police effort. I mean, in the annals of government, it's an extraordinary achievement.
How long did that last?
Over 200 years.
Hmm.
I mean, it was amazing.
That's a lot of coastline, Charles.
I know. A lot of coastline, a lot of everything.
Well, are there any long, or I should say, are there any long odd chances for the restoration of any monarchies in Central South America?
Well, I wouldn't. On the one hand, I wouldn't hold my breath. But on the other hand, here's the funny thing. In Mexico, of course, you had the brief empire of Maximilian. And when they initially became independent, they had an empire. When Brazil became independent, they did so as a monarchy under a son of the king of Portugal. And they had emperors in Brazil until 1889. When the emperor abolished slavery and was overthrown by the slaveholders. So that was how they paid him back. But the thing is that you look at Latin American history since and the search for a strong man.
Yeah, like Russia. It's like Russia.
Like Russia. And what you really see is an attempt to fill the empty throne. And because you can't really fill the empty throne with a strong man, you just keep trying and trying and trying. I noticed that in recent years, the Latin American countries have gathered together with Spain and Portugal, this Ibero-American treaty. They have annual meetings and so forth. And it's at one of these that King Juan Carlos, the former king of Spain, he's the president of this organization, not him personally now, but the king of Spain. He's president of the Ibero-American organization. And they were having one of their heads of state meetings, which the king of Spain presides over. And Hugo Chavez, the late president of Venezuela, started yapping about Spanish colonialism, how terrible it all was, and blah, blah, blah. And the king told him to shut up. But he did so. He did so in a way that you only tell children to.
Right.
You know, basically, shut up, baby.
So if you were to predict, and we only have a few minutes left, if you were to predict where, other than Liechtenstein and Monaco, there might be a return to a monarchy, a Catholic ruler, where would you see that happening?
As things stand at the moment, I would think the likeliest place would be in Eastern Europe, either one of the Balkan states, which is a whole other thing we haven't gotten into, but they have very strong monarchist groups there, and their respective heirs all live in the royal palaces. The other alternative is Central Europe. I would not be surprised to see a restoration of the Habsburgs. But I do believe, in general, that as Europe faces more and more pressure from outside, from the Islamic world and so forth, she will be forced to re-examine her roots, and that includes both the altar, Catholicism, and the throne, monarchy. Now, what form that'll take, what it'll look like, who knows? But nevertheless, I suspect it will return one way or the other.
Why do you suspect that? I mean, that does seem like a very long Oz situation. Why?
That seems odd, simply because we're living at the time and place we're living. But the reason I say it is because if Europe is to survive as Europe, she has to regain her roots. And all the European nations were made by our monarchs. We, the United States, are the only nation in the world that can claim to have been created by a Republican revolution. And even that is only partial.
What, not Italy? Oh, you're talking about all that prehistory in Italy before the revolution.
No. I mean, Italy, the Italian Republic, to this day, the president lives in the royal palace.
Right.
And his guards are in the royal uniforms.
So give us a reading list in terms of catching up with the Catholic understanding of monarchy and monarchism and what we really should know about it.
Well, believe it or not, I hate to recommend my own book.
This is an open invitation for you to do that.
All right. Well, I would recommend Star Spangled Crown, not simply because it's a wonderful book, but also because it has a very thorough reading list catch. But there are also books like Splendor and Exile, Kings Without Thrones, etc., that talk about heirs. There is a book entitled Simply Monarchy, which is a good overview of the institution. And I would say that The Death of Democracy is The End of Democracy. That's just come out, is another good one. Hans Hoppe's Democracy, The God That Failed, that talks about monarchy. Above all, I recommend a book by Father Aidan Nichols, O.B.
He's my own book. He's one of my heroes.
Yes, mine too. He's probably my favorite living theologian. So I recommend his two books. One is called Christendom Awake, and the other is called The Realm. If you even don't read mine, which, of course, is a terrible mistake, you're an evil person. But
that's right. That's right. We know that.
But even if you don't, you'll be saved partially if you read Father Nicholas's two books on the topic.
And those two are, once again?
They are called Christendom Awake and The Realm.
And the name of the two books of your own that you recommend the most?
On this topic, I would say Star Spangled Crown and The Pope's Legion.
And to our listeners who would be inclined to go look these up, I want to remind you of how to spell Charles's name. Charles A. Coulombe, C-O-U-L-O-U-M-B-E, correct?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you.
It's C-O-U-L-O-M. B as in boy, E.
Okay. C-O-U-L-O-M-B-E, Coulombe. Charles A. Coulombe, Star Spangled
Crown.
Crown, and what was the other one?
The other one is The Pope's Legion, which is the story of the Papal's Wives.
Well, that's what I'm going to get. So I'll read that, and you'll come back on the show and talk about the Pope's armies.
Do whatever you like.
I find that a fascinating idea, you know, just how, in fact, it was in the early and middle 19th century, the Pope gathered armies who would die for him and for the land which he saw as himself as a sovereign, not just as the pontiff. So, Charles, we'll look forward to having you back again. I hope everyone will go to the Christian Review and see the latest film that Charles reviewed, The Rider. It's a wonderful movie about cowboys and their lives, and Charles gave it a thumbs up, a five-star review. And so, Charles, thanks for what you're doing at Christian Review, and look forward to having you back the next time.
Me too. Take care, dear. God bless you.
And all you are listening, well, I'll be back this day, this time, next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.